We're reading this morning from Mark chapter 7. We're reading from Mark 7, verse 24, through to chapter 8, verse 10. Jesus left that place and went to the vicinity of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know it, yet he could not keep his presence secret. In fact, as soon as she heard about him, a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an impure spirit came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek born in Syrian Phoenicia. She begged Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. "First, let the children eat all they want," he told her, "for it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." "Lord," she replied, "even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Then he told her, "For such a reply you may go. The demon has left your daughter." She went home and found her child lying on the bed and the demon gone. Then Jesus left the vicinity of Tyre and went through to Sidon, down to the Sea of Galilee and into the region of the Decapolis. There some people brought to him a man who was deaf and could hardly talk, and they begged Jesus to place his hand on him. After he took him aside, away from the crowd, Jesus put his fingers into the man's ears. Then he spit and touched the man's tongue. He looked up to heaven and with a deep sigh said to him, "Ephphatha," which means "be opened." At this, the man's ears were opened, his tongue was loosened, and he began to speak plainly. Jesus commanded them not to tell anyone, but the more he did so, the more they kept talking about it. People were overwhelmed with amazement. "He has done everything well," they said. "He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak." During those days, another large crowd gathered. Since they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said, "I have compassion on these people. They have already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way because some of them have come a long distance." His disciples answered, "But where in this remote place can anyone get enough bread to feed them?" "How many loaves do you have?" Jesus asked. 7, they replied. He told the crowd to sit down on the ground. When he had taken the 7 loaves and given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to distribute to the people, and they did so. They had a few small fish as well. He gave thanks for them also and told the disciples to distribute them. The people ate and were satisfied. Afterward, the disciple picked up 7 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. About 4,000 people were present. After he sent them away, he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the region of Dalmanutha.
Well, one of the great difficulties of reading the Bible is trying to read it with fresh eyes. 2,000 years of church history and mission has removed any sort of surprise that we might feel that Jesus has come for Gentiles as well as for Jews. We take it for granted that God would be as willing to save us here in Kendal as he would to save a son of Abraham in Jerusalem. Add to that our culture of entitlement, taught from a young age that we have a right, an automatic right to absolutely everything. And you come to passages like this and think, well, what's the fuss all about? Jesus goes to the Gentiles. Why is that good news? But for Mark's first readers, this would be astonishing. Imagine yourself there, a Gentile sat in first century Rome, perhaps sat outside, reading in the sun, reading your copy of Mark's Gospel. You'd read that God's King has come into the world and teaches with all authority and astonishing wisdom. But what a tragedy. He's the King of the Jews and not the King of the Romans. Jesus has established a kingdom with no place for evil spirits or sickness or sin. It's just a shame that you're not welcome there, not being a son of Abraham. Jesus has power to save from death, but what's to say, Gentile reader, that he has any intention of saving you? In fact, any of the good news in Mark's gospel suddenly becomes very bad news because it becomes out of our reach. Just recently, Colin Buchanan, the Christian children's singer, has announced his tour dates, but to my dismay, they're all in Australia. Colin Buchanan has not come from us. He's beyond our reach. We should reach this point in Mark's gospel and be on our knees begging to be included, and so should rejoice with every syllable of these stories that we read here today. They're to teach us how Jesus treats those who are far away, and so they teach us how Jesus treats us. So let's turn there and enjoy. How does Jesus treat those who are far away? Well, firstly, he feeds them with food from his table. The Old Testament prophets had predicted that the Gentiles would one day be included in God's plan. But at the present time, the teaching of the elders said, consider them as dirty, as contaminating, sort of like how you treat someone with a cold. You push them off at a distance because you don't want to catch what they've got. And so it's a great shock, isn't it, when we come to verse 24. Jesus left that place and went to the vicinity of Tyre. That's the equivalent of Jesus leaving his trench, walking over no man's land and going into the enemy trenches. Tyre is in modern-day Lebanon, and they had a long history of hostility towards Israel. Josephus, a historian at the time, said that they were notoriously our bitterest enemies. They were the bad guys, the terrorists, the pagan influence to be kept out at all costs. And yet Jesus willingly goes over the border and amongst enemy lines, where he comes across a woman who was very Gentile, if we can describe it quite that way. She was a Gentile by birth and a Gentile by culture. Verse 26, the woman was Greek, culturally, and born in Syrian Phoenicia. It would seem that Jesus is keeping a low profile in the area. Perhaps he's wanting to concentrate on his disciples for a time. But somehow news leaks out, as it does, and she hears, she comes, and she begs Jesus to cast out the impure spirit from her daughter. In some ways, she's very similar to Jairus in that way. Both come to Jesus, both fall at his feet, and both beg for their daughter's life. But in other ways, they're very different. They couldn't be more different. He was an insider, a man, a Jew, a synagogue leader with status. He could come up with a long list of reasons why Jesus should be helping him. She was an outsider, a woman, a Gentile, with no status. Her only qualification was for help was her desperate need. We need to be careful when it comes to verse 27, don't we? And Jesus says, "First, let the children eat all they want," he told her, "for it's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." And there's a lot of discussion in the books over what Jesus means by that. Is Jesus being rude? Is Jesus being racist? Did he just call her a dog? Some would say, no, this is just a parable. Just in the same way as we might say that someone is sick as a parrot without implying that they have a beak and wings and squawk and that kind of thing. Perhaps it's just a turn of phrase. And naturally, he's talking about a beloved family pet rather than some mangy street dog. But others would disagree and would point to the almost universal bad press that dogs get in the Bible. They're described as scavengers. I'd want to walk a careful line between both. Jesus is not being unnecessarily rude and certainly not racist. Quite the opposite. Jesus is going to other nations. Lots of the values that we hold dear today about race started with Jesus and stem from a Christian worldview. Rather, he's acknowledging that at this time, this woman has no right to expect help from him. His question can be read almost as asking, well, why do you think that you should be fed? Why should I heal your daughter? It's almost a test. Just as Jairus's daughter wasn't healed immediately, her daughter isn't going to be healed straight away. He wants to draw her out. He wants to teach a lesson. Verse 28, Lord, she replied, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. She listens and she concedes. She is not a child. She is not a Jew. She has no birthright giving her a ticket for Jesus' help. But she points out that once the children have fed, there's usually leftovers, enough for all the dogs to eat as well. Which takes us back to the feeding of the 5,000, doesn't it? Jesus had fed his people to satisfaction, and what was left over? It was 12 baskets of leftovers. This woman has asked for no more than the contents of those baskets. It's a fantastic answer, which shows great faith and great humility. She recognizes others do have a prior claim to Jesus. She can only appeal to God's generosity. She asks for a few crumbs, but knowing full well that all it will take for healing is for those few crumbs. And Jesus says, good answer. Verse 29, for such a reply you may go. The demon has left your daughter. She went home and found her child lying on a bed with the demon gone. Did you know that this woman is the first person in Mark to actually get one of Jesus' parables? Everyone had failed to understand them. They'd failed to put themselves into this parable, and so they'd struggled with the meaning of it. They've heard, but they've not listened. And yet this Gentile enters in humbly and claims Jesus' offer. Yes, Jesus had to feed the children first. God had made promises to the children of Abraham. But God's plan had always been to bless the Gentiles through the Jews. He may even be hinting that, as he says, first, let the children eat all they want, implying that there will be a time when the Gentiles will be fed. But her faith, her answer, gets her a foretaste of what's promised. It gets her the starter course. She receives exactly the same blessing as Jairus does. She receives her daughter back to her. What I think this story does is it keeps us humble. The minister D.T. Niles famously defined evangelism as one beggar telling another beggar where they can find a loaf of bread. And that's what this woman does for us. Most of us, I assume here, are probably Gentiles, with no reason to expect Jesus' help, no claim to it, but our desperate need. Perhaps we need to learn what this woman will teach us. To recognize ourselves in this parable, not as children by birth, but as dogs, begging for God's help with empty hands. Ephesians 2 asks us to remember that at that time you were separate from Christ, excluded from citizenship in Israel, foreigners to the covenant of the promise, without hope and without God in the world. Shame on you if you think you deserve Jesus' blessing. Shame on you if you think that God owes you one. Shame on you if you're going to let pride get in the way of your coming to Jesus for help. Empty-handedness is always the starting point of grace and is the glory of the gospel. Nothing in my hand I bring, simply to thy cross I cling. Naked, come to thee for dress. Helpless, look to thee for grace. Foul, I to the fountain fly. Wash me, Saviour, or I die. Out of his grace and generosity, Jesus feeds those who are naturally far from his table. But let's move on to the second part of our story. Not only does he feed them, but he helps them to hear. Now, we've seen Jesus healing before. We've seen him deal with leprosy, with paralysis, with crushed hands, with persistent bleeding. Now, what we've not seen Jesus do yet is open the ears of the deaf. And that becomes particularly worrying when we think back to the parable of the sower. Jesus says, "Whoever has ears to hear, let them hear, and consider carefully what you hear." That's a particular challenge if you're deaf, isn't it? As it seems like lots of the people around Jesus are, not physically, but spiritually. They just don't seem to be able to hear properly. Now, Jesus has moved on, but he's still within Gentile territory here. He was in Tyre and Sidon in the north, but what he does is he travels roughly 120 miles round the top of the Sea of Galilee, going down on the right-hand side, all the way down to the region of the Decapolis. And it would seem that the man who had legion driven out of him has been at his work. The last time that we were in the Decapolis, Jesus had sent him to the towns to tell them how much the Lord has done for them and how God has had mercy upon them. And here now we see the townspeople coming to Jesus and asking for that mercy. Verse 32. There some people brought to him a man who was deaf and could hardly talk, and they begged Jesus to place his hands on them. After he took him aside, away from the crowd, Jesus put his fingers into the man's ears. Then he spat and touched the man's tongue. He looked up to heaven and with a deep sigh said to him, "Ephphatha," which means "be opened." At this, the man's ears were opened and his tongue was loosed and he began to speak plainly. Now, some people think that this miracle was a particularly hard one for Jesus, hence why he had to stick his fingers in his ears and do the whole thing with saliva on the tongue. That seems very unlikely to me. If Jesus can raise a little girl from the dead with just a word, it seems strange that he would struggle with this miracle. It's more likely that what he's doing is that he's communicating to the man in a way that will get through to him. Almost like sign language. Part of Jesus' care for the man is that he wants to bring him along with him, to teach him in the miracle and show him what's happening. As does his deep groan or his sigh. He's deeply moved by this man's deafness, and maybe by the spiritual deafness around him as well. You can imagine the man's trials. Unable to communicate to the world, and the world unable to communicate to him. Frustrating, difficult, but most of all, probably lonely. We're made to communicate, to be sociable people, and we find that hard when we're cut off, almost like living in a bubble. But at Jesus' command, this man's ears are opened and his tongue is unchained. You can watch all sorts of videos these days. You can even watch videos of people receiving cochlear implants for the first time ever. They're almost like hearing aids, but beefed up. And the joy and the tears that spread over their faces, they hear their loved ones speak to them for the first time, is really quite amazing. It's moving. Imagine this man's joy as into his world of muffled silence he hears the words, "Be opened," and his ears spring to life and his tongue is loosed with joy. He can't stop from telling others about it. We're being taught what it takes to heal spiritual deafness. It takes a miracle for this man to hear, and the same is true for us. It takes a miracle to open up our ears and to hear the message of Jesus. And so we come back again to humility. None of us can boast a special spiritual receptiveness when even hearing is a gift from God. But there's more going on than just healing. The language that Mark picks points us backwards. Two events had dominated the Old Testament, the Exodus and the exile, where God's people had been carried off into slavery. But God had promised that one day he would bring them back out of slavery, just as he'd rescued them from slavery in Egypt with the Exodus. Isaiah describes that in Isaiah chapter 35. He says, "The deserts and the parched land will be glad. The wilderness will rejoice and blossom like the crocus. Then will the eyes of the blind be open and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then will the lame leap like a deer and the mute tongue shall shout for joy." Mark deliberately echoes Isaiah 35, as if to say, this is it, guys. This is the return from exile. But surprise, it's not just for the Jews, it's for Gentiles too. This rescue plan is bigger than you ever imagined. Isaiah goes on, "Those the Lord has rescued will return. They will enter Zion with singing. Everlasting joy will crown their heads. Gladness and joy will overtake them, and sorrow and sighing will flee away." If I had to say at this point, well, that's nice, but it's not for you as Gentiles, this would be a very different sermon, wouldn't it? But praise God, I don't have to. This is for us too. We can look forward entering into the heavenly Zion, the heavenly Jerusalem, with no more sighing, no more hearing loss, no more speech impediments. Everlasting joy, gladness and joy will overtake them, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. Imagine that. Imagine sorrow and sighing running out of the back door, never to be seen again. The Jews back then would want to draw a line around that, to draw a line around God's grace and say, well, it ends here with the borders of Israel. But Jesus deliberately pushes those boundaries out. There was an article in the BBC News this last week of a Belgian farmer who's moved a marker stone which marked the boundary between Belgium and France. Apparently it was getting in his way, and so he picked it up and he moved it 2 meters over the border into France and nearly sparked a diplomatic incident. Imagine Jesus here picking up one of those boundary stones and carrying it all the way from Israel's border up to the North Pole and up to the South Pole. God's blessings are no longer limited by national boundaries. And so this is a lesson for us to subtly bring those boundaries back in, not to subconsciously put people beyond the reach of God's grace. Jesus is for all nations, all races, and all backgrounds. We want to say more than our culture. We want to say, yes, Black Lives Matter. But we want to say, yes, all lives matter as well. It is part of God's glory when we demonstrate that in the church, when our friendships stretch beyond those who are just like us to people who are very different. How are we doing with that as a church? How are you doing with that as an individual? Let me say very clearly, whatever it says on your passport, you are very welcome here in this church. But to return to how Jesus treats those who are far away. Firstly, he feeds them from his table. Secondly, he helps them to hear. And thirdly, he feeds them in the wilderness. You might have had a feeling of a strange sense of déjà vu as we read through it earlier. And indeed, there are lots of similarities between Mark 6 and Mark 8, the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000. Let me list just a few of them. There is a large crowd in a desert. We see Jesus' compassion, 6:34 and 8:2. There is hunger. There are loaves of bread and fish. There is no way to get more. The loaves are counted. The people sit down. Jesus gives thanks. The food is distributed. They eat and are satisfied, 6:42 and 8:8. The leftovers are collected and the crowd is dismissed. They're almost the mirror image of each other, these stories. So much so that some people have suggested that they're actually the same event, just being reported by two people. But if you say that, then you have some fair mental gymnastics to do to try and explain away the differences, some of the differences. One is reported in Jewish territory, the other in a Gentile area. One is after one day, the other after 3 days. One has 5 loaves and 2 fish, the other have 7 loaves and a few fish. In one, the disciples spot the problem. In the other, it's Jesus that spots the problem. In one, they use a Jewish style of basket. In the other, it's a Gentile design. In one, there are 12 baskets left over. In the other, there's 7 left over. And of course, there's a difference in the number. 5,000 men eat, plus more beside, or 4,000 all told. It's not the same event, but similar. The point is that Jesus is doing the same miracle, but he's doing it for the Gentiles, which is remarkable when we remember why he fed the 5,000. That meal in the desert had pointed back to the Exodus and had taught us that Jesus came to liberate his people from slavery. This feeding here includes the Gentiles in that. Jesus has just taken two of the most defining events of Israel's history, exile and Exodus, and included the Gentiles in there. There's another hint of that at the end of the story as he's dismissing the crowd in verse 9. About 4,000 were present. After he'd sent them away, he got into the boat. It's a little hidden by the limits of our translation, but it could say, about 4,000 were present. After he had liberated them, he got into the boat. Jesus has come to liberate both Jew and Gentile, not from slavery to Egypt or slavery to Rome, but as we were thinking about last week, from slavery to our sinful hearts. What a mighty, mighty Savior he is. How does Jesus treat those who are far off? It's answered even more clearly in verse 2. I have compassion for these people. Fun fact about that word compassion is that it comes from the Greek word meaning entrails or guts. The bowels or the stomach were seen back then as the seat of the emotion, just like we might say that we have butterflies in our stomach. That's where the thinking was coming from. Jesus is physically, gut-wrenchingly, viscerally moved with compassion when he thinks about this crowd and when he thinks about you and your need. It's a lie to think that Jesus is unloving, uncaring, or unfeeling. He is deeply moved when he thinks about your need before God. And what's more, he perpetually brings those needs to his Father. But notice how these stories all fit together. If we just had the story of the Syrophoenician woman, we might think that Jesus is willing to give us scraps, to give us crumbs, but little more. That might seem measly. But this feeding corrects that, and Jesus gives us more than enough to eat. Verse 8, the people ate and were satisfied. Afterwards, the disciples picked up 7 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. Jesus isn't stingy with his portion size because of who we were born to. There is equal room at Jesus' table for Jew and Gentile alike. All receive what they need and more beside. As David had said in Psalm 23, our cup overflows. It really is a marvellous description of Jesus, isn't it? Back in verse chapter 7, 37. The people were overwhelmed and amazed and said, he has done everything well. Who else could that be said of? All of our heroes, all of our celebrities, all of our leaders, they might do one or two things excellently, but no one does it like Jesus. He does everything well. He brings that same excellence to everything that he does, to his teaching, to his healing, to his protection, to his provision, even to his finished work on the cross. We can't point a finger at any part of Jesus' life or work and say there is room for improvement there. For our assurance and comfort, his work is perfect and complete. And what's more, it's open to us. Come with me to Mark chapter 15 and again to the foot of the cross. Mark chapter 15, verse 37, where it says, with a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And who is it? Who is it who's there, who has the honour of seeing it, of being the first to grasp Jesus' work in all its glory? It's not a Jew. It's not even a disciple. It's not even one of Jesus' friends or family. It's the very man who'd put him to death. A Roman centurion. A Gentile. Far from God, yet first in line to see and believe. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died, he said, surely, truly, this man was the Son of God. Jesus is under no obligation to save any of us. You might think of 1,000 good reasons why he wouldn't want to save you. But that's okay. We're all saved by grace and by grace alone. We are all very undeserving, but very welcome guests at Jesus' table. If only, like the Syrophoenician woman, we will come with empty hands, begging for God's help.